93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Stephen Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. It's hard to believe, but one quarter of 2016 is almost over. A lot of great music has already come out this year, so I thought it would be fun to devote this episode to two of my favorite albums of the year's first quarter. You just heard a song by Pinegrove, a band from New Jersey that bridges the gap between DIY punk and hardscrabble folk and country instrumentation. I'll be talking with Pinegrove's leader, Evan Stevens Hall, later in the episode about the band's wonderful new LP, Cardinal. But first, it's been 6 long years since Canadian hard rock band Black Mountain put out a record. The group first emerged in 2005 with its self-titled debut, an instant classic that married the riffs of Black Sabbath to the hypnotic grooves of the funky German prog rock group Can. After that came 2008's In the Future, Black Mountain's best record in my estimation, a stoner's wonderland balancing heaviness with otherworldly melodies. Black Mountain decided to take a break after 2010's Wilderness Heart, but the band has finally reconvened for 4, which comes out April 1st. As the title implies, Black Mountain is still part of a tradition that includes Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. But what makes 4 great, and yes, necessary in 2016, is that Black Mountain proves that you can still make epic-sounding rock music that gives no quarter to passing trends and fashions. Instead, Black Mountain continues to pursue its own idiosyncratic muse. In advance of the album's release, I spoke with Black Mountain singer Amber Weber, whose soaring rasp has long been the most beguiling aspect of Black Mountain's multi-layered sound. Here's our conversation. Amber, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Before we talk about the new record, 4, which I've heard and I love it. It's one of my favorite records that I've heard so far this year. Before we talk about that, though, I just wanted to say that you're one of my favorite rock singers of like the last 10 years. I love your voice. It's my favorite part of Black Mountain's sound. I'm wondering, like, do you have any like role models in terms of singers? You know, people that like you grew up looking up to, or people that you like modeled yourself after in a way?
Oh yeah, sure. Well, I grew up in the '80s, so like it's a real mixed bag. Anybody when I was growing up, any woman singer that just gave it and didn't give a fuck was kind of like blew my mind, basically. Like even singers like Cyndi Lauper, for instance, or like Patti Smith, or I had like an obsessive like Bjork phase, you know. It just kind of like, and of course all like the 60s, 70s singers. Your typical like Stevie Nicks and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, I've heard. Like Stevie Nicks, I've seen that as a reference point for you a lot in reviews and stuff. Like,
yeah.
I mean, do you see her as someone that you would liken yourself to in terms of like the sound of your voice or the kind of singing you do?
I mean, yeah, honestly, like I haven't dissected like Stevie Nicks like I have with other artists. Actually. If I were to, like, Fleetwood Mac for me is, like, I love Fleetwood Mac so much, but Lindsey Buckingham is, like, as far as, like, a vocalist goes, like, oh, my God, he's one of my favorite vocalists of all time. And I love Stevie Nicks, too, don't get me wrong. But Lindsey Buckingham is, like, a huge inspiration for harmonies and things like that. Like, I just love his sensibility with just with weird harmony stuff and adding oohs and ahs and things like that in weird places.
He's also a really intense singer. I saw him play live a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And like he sings like when he sings Go Your Own Way like one of those like Rumours songs, you'd think that he would be over it by now, but it's like he can still feel the sting of Stevie Nicks dumping him.
Totally. Yeah, totally. I went and saw Fleetwood Mac about a year ago. And it was sort of a last-minute thing where a couple friends and I thought, let's just go and see what we can get. And we ended up sitting right beside where Lindsey Buckingham was. So I was checking him out, and he's so intense. Like, his guitar playing and just when he has those solo moments on stage, you know, he's a real ham almost.
Oh, but, yeah.
But, yeah, he's a bit of a cheese ball, but, man, I loved watching him, like, so intense. It's good.
And he's very tan and, like, lithe, too. Like, he's, like, 63, but he has, like, the body of, like, a One Direction band member.
No. And he's wearing these, like, you know, like, majorly tight, what do you call those, like, tight pants, like, for men, you know? And it was like, holy shit, okay. Like,
the Pilates are paying off.
Totally.
For him. I mean, have you always been a singer? I mean, or was there a point where you discovered that, like, oh, I can do this?
I just started singing, like, I feel like right away. Like, I can't remember a time when I was constantly singing. I have a twin sister. I don't know. And her and I would sing, like, every day. Like, we'd make songs up. I actually don't have much from my childhood, but I do have, like, one cassette tape of just, like, my sister Ashley and I just singing back and forth, doing harmonies together and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you mentioned Fleetwood Mac before, and that is an interesting reference point with Black Mountain because, you know, they obviously have the male and female voices playing off of each other, and, you know, you have an interesting role in the band in that, you know, there are songs where you sing lead, and there's other songs where you're acting as a counterpoint. Like, I think of that song, you know, Stormy High from In the Future, and just the sound of your voice at the beginning of that song. Like, you're not the lead singer necessarily on that song, but just the, like, when you're singing over that sort of opening riff, it's such an awesome album opener. Like, it just sounds so great. I mean, is that something that, does that just come out of jamming together? Like, how much do you guys sort of plan the interplay of the vocals?
Yeah, I guess we do a bit of that jamming. Honestly, like, a lot of the time we'll, like, record jams or we'll record demos, and then I just fuck around with it on my own a bit and then bring it back to practice. Because, like, when you're rehearsing with a big, loud rock band, it's hard to, like, really hone in the vocals because it's so loud. And, you know, in a practice, the vocals are always sort of buried, you know? Steve and I will get together once in a while and just do, like, a vocal rehearsal. Or, well, mostly for ballads and stuff like that, but yeah, no, that's, like, the funnest part of being in Black Mountain for me is just writing harmonies. It's so much fun for me. I never get bored of it.
And that's not something that you necessarily think about with hard rock bands, you know, with harmonies or vocals. I mean, a lot of times that's almost like a secondary aspect of it, too. I mean, did you grow up, I mean, you mentioned, like, a lot of, like, pop music that you listened to in the 80s. Like, did you also have, like, a metal side or a hard rock side, or did that come later?
I had a brother 5 years older than me, so, like, it was definitely a part of my life. But it was, no, like, my parents are really into, like, kind of more, like, Pink Floyd-y kind of stuff, and my brother was into kind of cheese nut, metal, like rock, kind of like Twisted Sister. And I guess so, like, like Judas, anything like Judas Priest or like anything like that would have come later.
What was the turning point for you in that regard? Like, was there a certain record that you heard, or did you have, like, was there like a friend that turned you on to that stuff?
I mean, God, like, as soon as I was a teenager, like, just hanging out at, like, punk houses and it was just, like, that was a huge part of just being of that age, you know? Like, just people just making you mixtapes and pumping the tunes really loud, and it's just, it suited the energy at the time, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't really listen to a lot of, like, kind of that kind of music these days, but... it's definitely, like, a huge part of growing up, you know?
Like, where are you at now as far as your music listening habits?
Let's see.
You said you don't really listen to, like, much hard rock anymore. Like,
well, I do. I mean, I totally do. Like, I mean, it's all around me all the time. Like, but like, what I don't like always. It's not always like the first thing I put on, you know.
Yeah.
This week, I'm really like obsessed with this. It's actually a Randy Newman song, but it's a Nina Simone version that's like killing me. Baltimore.
Oh yeah.
So good. I love that shit. So, and that album is not all good, but it definitely has some rad, wicked moments. I'm talking about the Nina Simone. And Randy Newman's cool too. And but I don't know, I'm just all over the place with music. Yeah, I don't know. What else have I been listening to this week?
It's funny that you bring
Scott.
Up... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's funny you bring up Baltimore because... I interviewed Kurt Vile last year. I spent some time with them, and he loves that song too. Like, he mentioned that song specifically as being a song that he loved.
Oh, really?
And I mean, you said you like the Nina Simone version more than the Randy Newman version.
Well, I like them both. I mean, I think Randy Newman wrote the song, right?
Yeah.
So I got to give him some credit for that. And his version's really cool. Actually, I was listening, I was driving yesterday and I put them both on back to back because I'm a nerd. I was like, I want to hear them both. And I really love them both. Right? That's hilarious that Kurt Vile said that. I like his new album, actually.
Yeah, that's really great too.
I thought it's pretty cool. The lyrics are hilarious. Yeah. great songs though, like great songs. I love that last song on I forget what it's called, but the last song on that album is really beautiful.
Yeah, is that Wild Imagination, I think.
Yeah,
that's a great song. Yeah, because when I was talking to Kurt about that Randy Newman song, I think that album, that song is on like Land of Dreams or something, like one of the 80s albums.
Mm-hmm. And
just talking about like the 80s cheese of Randy Newman albums, like from that era, and like how it's sort of a stumbling block at first, but then you get past it and you're just like, oh, this is great, you know? Like,
no, I know, it's so good. That's pretty good.
So let's transition from Randy Newman cheese to the new Black Mountain record here. This will be the worst segue ever. So, you know, this will be the first Black Mountain record to come out in 6 years or so, five and a half, 6 years. And I know you guys have talked about this before, but, you know, there was a break that you took after, you know, you put out Wilderness Heart in 2010 and then you were touring, and I know you toured a long time. And I mean, is it fair to say that you were sort of burned out from the road and needed to take a break for a while?
Yeah, a little of that, maybe. There's just so much going on with all of us at the time. I would say, like, Steve moved to L.A. to just kind of follow the lady to L.A. So that kind of, you know, made things slightly hard. I guess you could say we needed a break, maybe. We had management at the time that was kind of stupid. And
Like how so?
What's that?
Like you said your management was kind of stupid. Like, how so?
Oh, I mean, they were great. They were doing their thing, but it just didn't work for us. I mean, they were great for what they were doing, but so I don't know. Everything sort of I just felt like we needed a break. A lot of touring and we didn't really like we did take time between albums, but in that time, we were always touring, so we didn't really have too much of a break for a long time as a band. And it's been really cool to have the break, and actually to have a break between the last album and this album. But also, we had our 10-year anniversary of the first album come out,
right?
And it was just hilarious because it was like a shock to our system. Like, oh my god, it's been 10 years! What the hell? And it was neat because then we actually, while we were in the midst of recording four, we were also touring the reissue of the 10-year anniversary album. So we were revisiting all these new songs, old songs. And so that was kind of neat, like sort of playing all these songs we sort of forgot about. And also after having taken a break, so it sort of... reset us in a cool little mind frame for making this new album.
I mean, when you take this break, I mean, is that sort of a formal decision? Like, do you guys get together and say, because I know you have Lightning Dust, Steven has like a couple different bands, I know all the other members have their own stuff going on. I mean, is that sort of like a explicit thing, like, okay, we're going to take a break, or did that just sort of happen organically?
Yeah, no, we never say like, okay, let's take a break, let's make it a few years, let's all put out, other albums with other people. But I think like sometimes we think we need a break, and then we're home for a week and we get bored and then we want to write music. So then we make like a Lightning Dust album, or we make a whatever, Pink Mountaintops album,
Yeah.
So it's just, we're all like busy brains. Can't relax.
I mean, as far as, getting four going, I mean, is it just a matter of like Steven calling you up and saying, hey, I have some songs that I think are Black Mountain songs and, let's record them? Or how does that come about?
Yeah. It's sort of different a little bit sometimes. Like, I think he was starting to fly out, and then Josh the drummer in Black Mountain, and I have a studio in town, in Vancouver, and so we would just go to our studio and jam some songs, just kind of without any real expectation. That was happening for a bit, and then he was also sending us some demos, just real rough demos. But actually, even Jeremy, the keyboard player, like Mothers of the Sun off the new album, we went to a Sonoya Cave show, which is Jeremy, the keyboard player in Black Mountain solo project. We went to a Sonoya Cave show, the rest of Black Mountain, and he just started playing Mothers of the Sun, which is like a Black Mountain song that we sort of abandoned from years ago. He started playing with a vocoder, so it was like robot vocals and like this, what you hear now on the song, the beginning part. And that was his version of it. And it was like, whoa, holy shit, I haven't heard that song in so long. And it was sort of his way of reintroducing it, like, let's work on this fucking song. Because we'd always abandoned it. It was driving him crazy. So it's always different. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like once you got together, I mean, did you find that was a fairly, I mean, did this record come together pretty quickly, or was it kind of spread out over a while, the recording of it?
Yeah, we tried to write for a while, and it just wasn't really happening. I don't think we were fully in it, and then, so we sort of took a bit of a break, a few months, maybe 6 month break, and then kind of came back to it, and then we were just like writing like crazy. And then we had tons of songs, like way too many. And then we booked some time with Randall Dunn at Avast Studios in Seattle. And we just recorded a bunch of stuff. I think it was just like maybe 2 weeks. And then we took a month off. And then we went back for another 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. So like the actual recording part happened pretty quick.
But
the writing did not.
Right. I mean, the writing, it sounds like that was maybe, like, was that like a couple years even, would you say?
Yeah, maybe like a year and a half, something like that.
You know, you mentioned earlier about how the 10th anniversary of the first Black Mountain record, it occurred, while you were making this record, and you played a tour in support of that and revisited a lot of those old songs. And, I mean, it sounds like, is it fair to say that was that like a revitalizing thing in a way? I mean, did it kind of make you feel differently about your own past, or maybe more excited about it maybe than you had been earlier?
Yeah, it's cool. It's neat. It was neat to visit these. I think for everyone, actually, it was neat. You kind of realize like how much you've changed. Like, we've all changed, but at the same time, there's a sort of essence of the band that you're like, oh yeah, this is what Black Mountain is, I think that was really nice timing on that with the new album.
Now, I mean, when that first record came out, I mean, there wasn't really another band, certainly not an indie rock, that was like Black Mountain. And I would say that, you know, like 11 years later, that's even more the case. I mean, you guys seem to exist on your own island that is impervious to other, you know, things that are going on in indie rock. I mean, indie rock right now certainly is not very rock and roll. I mean, there's not a lot of, like, it seems to be more pop driven maybe than it's ever has been. I'm wondering, like, if you have any feelings about that. And I mean, is it hard to, you know, to do your own thing and to you sort of resist the trends that are happening, you know, like when you're trying to make records and have an audience? I mean, is that a difficult thing?
I don't think we would ever get sucked into any of these trends that are happening, because, oh my God, it's like listening to some music that's coming out these days. It's like, I'll read something like, oh yeah, like this woman's got this amazing voice and this music's like unreal. And so I'm like, oh cool. And then I listen to him like, oh my God, it sounds like she's like a baby singing like in the 50s. Like, it's like, wow, be darling. I don't understand.
Okay, you got to tell me who you're talking about right there, because we got to know who the baby is.
I don't know. It's like the same shit that's on like long distance commercials or whatever, you know? It's like that sort of like recipe that's like going wild right now with the women singers. It's bumming me out. But that's not to say there's not like tons of good female singers out there. But yeah, I honestly don't know the name of these bands, but like it's like a joke. Like, I put it on and it's like my friends and I are just like, ah, turn off. But no, I don't think any of us really pay attention to like current trends and that kind of thing, you know. I can say this, that everyone in Black Mountain is so bloody different, like with musical tastes. Like, I mean, we all love the same sort of stuff, but like, man, like when Jeremy throws a, like when he writes like a synth like keyboard solo, I'm just like, what the planet are you from, man? It's crazy. Like, I would have never thought like you were gonna write something like that. Like, it's fucking crazy. It's awesome. And yeah, I just think just everyone's just, I think that's what makes Black Mountain cool, is like we're all just kind of weird, like weirdos in our own way, and then we get together and it's like, oh, holy shit. It's like always surprising to me what people come up with, you know?
Well, and the thing that I really responded to when I first heard the new record, which is called Four, is just how like unabashedly like epic it sounds. And that's probably something you could say about every Black Mountain record. But maybe because there hasn't been a Black Mountain record in a while, it like really kind of hit me in the right place. I was wondering, I mean, like, when you are making records, like, you know, like this, I mean, are you in a way almost like trying to make the kind of record that you would want someone else to make, like, that you could just enjoy as a fan?
Yeah, I guess it's like most musicians are trying to make, like, a record that they want to listen to. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. Yeah, I think, I'm certainly trying my best to make something listenable.
Like a record with no singing babies, anyway.
I don't know if I described that quite right.
I like that. No, I think you're right on the money with that. And the other thing that jumped out to me about this record, of course, when I first got the promo, was that it's called Four, with the Roman numeral four, which any rock fan knows there's a long history of bands naming the record Four, and there's lots of great records and there's like some like not so great records. But to me, that was almost like you're throwing down the gauntlet by calling it that. And, you know, obviously it's your fourth record, so it suits it in that respect. But
yeah.
I mean, there must have been some thought that like people were going to make connections to like Led Zeppelin 4 or Black Sabbath Volume 4 or Toto 4 or whatever.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's exactly what it was. It was like, oh, we got to call this album 4. I mean, come on. You know, it wasn't like, I think it was like a 2-second discussion and it was settled, you know?
So, I mean, so clearly you're saying that this is like as good as Led Zeppelin 4, right? I mean,
of course. Just kidding.
It's the connection you want people to make. So,
I don't think so.
So, like, when you... So, I assume that you're going to be touring a lot behind this record, right?
Yeah. It kind of blows my mind when I look at the tour itinerary.
And I mean... You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, I mean, you guys have toured a lot. You were sort of touring nonstop there for a while. I mean, do you like being on the road that much? I mean, you know, speaking of like rock history, there's like lots of rock songs about how hard being on the road is, you know, from Turn the Page, you know, on down. I mean,
thinking that exact song. I was like, Turn the Page.
Exactly. I mean, does that get to be hard or do you really enjoy that kind of lifestyle?
I find it pretty hard actually, but you're going to get into the groove of things, you know? I don't know. I get kind of, we've been rehearsing every night this week, and we were just all talking about our, like, tour anxieties. I think we all get it pretty bad, you know? It's like, oh, okay, all right. I mean, I love playing every night, and I could do that for the rest of my life, but it's a lot of, like, just, like, then you kind of get into, well, I get into, like, a sort of neuroses or, I don't know, I get kind of dark on the road, like, especially on the long drives, you start thinking about, like, different ways you could die.
Oh, man.
It gets dark, man. I'm like, okay, what if the van, like, what if, like, a bee flew into, like, Josh's face and he just cranked the van over to the right and then we flew off this cliff, you know, it's like...
Oh, man.
It gets weird. Yeah.
I think if you avoid like air travel seems to be bad for bands historically. You know, yeah. From like Buddy Holly to Skinner to, you know, Randy Rhoads, all those people. I think if you avoid that, you should be okay. I think that's sort of like reverse thinking. I think air travel is supposed to be safer, but it seems like for rock and roll, it's maybe more dangerous for some reason.
Yeah. Also that, like, flights are just, I mean, you could go on a 2-hour flight, but you're still, like, in the airport for, like, 6 hours. It makes for a long day, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you have any, like, rituals that, you know, or, you know, things that you like to do on the road just to keep yourself sane?
I don't know. It's a nice time for me, like, to visit. I get pretty deep into, like, listening to albums. I love, because you're sitting there. It's nice to listen to some music. And, you know, how often in your life do you have time where you just have to be somewhere and you have no choice but to, I don't know, you can just listen to music. It's nice.
Right.
That's a nice part about planes and long drives. Things like that. I always find, like, when people are sort of trapped together, like on a road trip or like at a cabin or something like that, that's when, like, really funny shit happens and creative stuff. And I don't know, you know, as humans, I don't think we really allow time for that kind of stuff to happen. So those are, there's some magical moments in touring for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely seems like a journey into the mind at times.
Yeah, totally. It's like, yeah, you don't know yourself. We'll try touring for a month. You'll figure it out.
Yeah. Well, Amber, again, I really love the new record, and I'm really glad there's a new Black Mountain record, and I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, that was Amber Weber from Black Mountain. Their album 4 will be out on April 1st, and I highly suggest checking it out. In the meantime, let's talk about a great record that came out last month. The latest Pine Grove album, Cardinal, is the culmination of 6 years of writing and recording by Evan Stevens Hall, who's been the band's only constant since 2010. Pine Grove first achieved wider exposure beyond the band's base in Montclair, New Jersey with the 2015 release, Everything So Far, which compiled all of the band's old recordings. But it's Cardinal that marks the full flowering of Hall's unique talent and Pine Grove's singular sound. I phoned Hall to talk about the record and to find out how Pine Grove got to this point. You know, I called you a couple minutes ago, and you were reading internet comments at the time, so you're having a big afternoon.
Well, I guess I found a few free moments to surf the web in my in between the really important events.
I mean, are you? I mean, because. Obviously, reading internet comments, that's not a good sign for a person if he's doing that. I hope you're doing okay today.
Thank you. I'm drinking an abnormal amount of almond milk. I wonder if it's maybe affecting my psychological state.
Does that have like psychedelic properties, like if you drink a lot of almond milk?
As far as I know, there's no psychotropic effect of the almond, but then again, everything in moderation, right? So
see, I think you could be a new brand of like rock guy, where, and you know, because we had people, you know, we've had rock people who drank, rock people who took drugs, but like you could open the doors of perception with almond milk.
I am an intrepid explorer of consciousness. Though, you know, allegedly, if you eat enough nutmeg, you'll hallucinate.
Is that right?
That's what they say.
Oh, wow. But you probably have to consume, like, an ungodly amount of nutmeg.
Yes. This is not from personal experience, but maybe it was somewhere pretty deep in the comments section when I found someone suggesting this, but also warning any participant that they might be knocked out for the next up to a week or something like that. But So I kind of decided it wasn't worth it to try it out.
Yeah, you don't want to have like a nutmeg overdose. That just seems like a weird thing to have on your permanent record.
On your resume.
Well, you know, Evan, thank you for coming on my podcast. I really appreciate it. I want to tell you that I love Cardinal. I think it's a great record. I've been listening to it all the time. And it's one of those records where I love recommending it to people, because it seems like everyone I recommend it to ends up loving it as much as I do. So,
wow. Cool. Thank you.
It's really great. You know, and I mean, I don't know how much you read your own press. I mean, maybe you're busy reading internet comment sections a lot, so you don't read your own press. But like, I mean, there's been a lot of great reviews of the record. One thing that I see come up a lot when people describe the sound of the band is describing it as a country sound, or I've seen the term country punk applied to Pine Grove. And personally, I'm not sure if that totally suits the band. I mean, you use, you know, there's pedal steel guitar on some songs, you know, you've used banjo on songs. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily hear a country influence, but I'm wondering, like, for you, do you listen to that kind of music, and do you feel like that influences what you do?
Yeah, I do. I do listen to that sort of stuff. I listen widely. So not just that stuff. I try to sample all sorts of things, but, growing up in the house, my parents were listening to, a lot of stuff in the range of Gillian Welsh, who I still consider one of my favorites, Lucinda Williams, but then also like Little Feat and Dr. John. I'm just imagining right now, as an aside, a combination of Little Feat and Dr. John results in Little John, who I also count as a huge influence. I think that there are overt signifiers in our music that are, twangy, that type of instrumentation. But I think there's something to that categorization, you know, as much as anything like that is worth. The songs are melodically direct, and that's a feature of a lot of traditional American music. which country takes a big influence and is a big part of, you know, R&B too, or folk. All of that is within my range of interest as a songwriter. So yeah, it doesn't faze me. You asked me if I read the reviews. I do. I read them all. I probably shouldn't. I think this was kind of the first time that we were written about, pretty much at all, besides just friends shouting about us on social media, which I've always appreciated and continue to appreciate. But it's been really interesting seeing what strangers think about it. It's really fascinating and flattering often to read their thoughts. I always kind of have this suspicion that I'm being a little bit misunderstood. And in the beginning, I was kind of pessimistic about it. Like, wow, maybe to gain a wider listenership just means definitionally to be widely misunderstood.
like how so? How do you feel like people don't understand maybe sometimes?
Well, I should say that I've evolved a little bit on that perspective. I think that it has a lot to do with just feeling like these songs are a very personal exercise and maybe having a little bit of a hard time letting them go to other people's interpretations. But I spend a lot of time on these puzzles for my own sake, for my own entertainment and cathartic process. And they end up being pretty involved. And I think my main complaint is I just wonder how long music journalists really end up listening to a thing before they write a piece that thousands of people read about it. And I know that, myself included, listeners are so susceptible to the power of suggestion that when they hear that something is twangy, for example, or rather, when they read it, they're going to hear that too in the song. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to direct the listener's attention with our music. And I just get a little disappointed when it's directed too firmly in any one direction.
I mean, you know, speaking as a music journalist, I think the perspective I would bring to that is that music journalists aren't much different than like any other listener in the respect that I think when most people, when they hear a song, there will be certain like lyrics that stand out to them. There'll be certain elements of the song that will stand out to them. And in some way, those elements that stand out become the whole package. So like if you hear like one lyric that kind of connects with you, that becomes what the song is about, even if there might be other things in the song. And, you know, different people hear different things in songs. So something that, you know, might sound twangy to one person, someone else might hear it and something else in the song connects to them and they don't notice the twang or whatever. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that's just a function of how people listen to music, maybe. Then it doesn't even matter if you're, like, you know, paid to have opinions about music or not. It's just how people listen. I think that's just what happens. I you know, if it's your job to listen, you hope to be more thoughtful about it and to be more self-aware. But I almost feel like that's inevitably that's going to happen. You know, you're going to bring your own baggage to a piece of art, sure. And that's going to affect how you hear it.
Yeah. I appreciate your perspective on that. And just to be clear, I'm not condemning music journalism as a whole. I think that actually responding textually to music is a really exciting thing. And there are a lot of people who do it really well.
Oh yeah.
I think maybe I'm talking more about the personal process for me about grappling with a wider listenership now all of a sudden, and acknowledging that maybe there's a role, there's like a more public or communal role my songs can have that aren't just these personal little puzzles anymore.
Oh, absolutely.
But they're, you know, is a more interactive thing, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, you've been, you know, writing and recording songs for several years now, and you're a part of this. I mean, from what I've read, the music community there where you live in Montclair, New Jersey, it sounds like it's a really great community, and there's other bands in the area, and you're friends with them, and you have a great audience there. And in, you know, you've said before that, like, you're used to writing songs for yourself and sort of expressing what you feel in your own heart and trying to make yourself feel better in a way when you're writing songs. And I have to imagine that it has to be somewhat it has to mess with your head a little bit, having these other opinions come into your head. And I mean, does that influence how you think of what you're doing? And if so, how do you keep that stuff out?
I'm not really sure yet how it's going to influence, because right. I haven't even really had a chance to write recently. You know, we've been playing a show pretty much every day, and I was doing this big painting project for the deluxe edition of Cardinal through Run for Cover, which took many, many hours, which turned out to be very fun and rewarding, but kind of a bigger project than I realized. So, and before Cardinal came out, I think I was a little bit prevented from really dedicating myself to a new project because I was still so invested with, you know, it hadn't come to term yet, so to speak. And now I'm beginning to develop a headspace where new ideas are coming, and I've got an idea for a new project that I like, and I'm starting to tinker with. But more broadly, though, I think that for a writer or a musician or an artist of any sort, it's important to identify your strengths and play them personally. And so, I know in my heart that I just need to trust my own sensibilities. That's the best tool I have.
Right.
And we'll see how effectively I can block out the noise. I don't know yet.
Well, you know, you know, we're talking about blocking out the noise. It, you know, I am now going to dump my thoughts on this record into your brain, and you cannot block them out either way. I mean, to me, when I listen to this record, to me, this is like a really articulate record about being inarticulate. You know, there's a lot of references to, I mean, the characters in the songs, I mean, they seem to speak in fragments. Sometimes they aren't speaking at all, like they want to speak, but they can't. Uh-huh. There's a lot of wandering going around, either, you know, physically walking around, but also sort of spiritual wandering happening in these songs. Mm-hmm. You know, my favorite song on the record is Aphasia, which I think is just a beautifully sort of sad song, but there's also a lot of mixed emotions in it, in that song, because there's also, you know, because aphasia, it refers to this disorder. It's a brain disorder where you have difficulty communicating, and it's usually caused by some sort of injury. And in the song, you know, there's joy because there's the character is finally able to communicate, but then maybe he's not communicating the best thing necessarily. At least that's what I take from the song. I mean, is this take that I have, does this ring true for you at all? Is this something that you had in your own mind, or what do you feel like, you know, you're trying to get at as a songwriter on this record?
Well, that's of course the big question. But at the same time, I feel excited to have an opportunity to talk about it. I think that your take is pretty similar to what I had in mind. I'm really interested in investigating the ways that we communicate. And for me, social anxiety has always been kind of a big factor in the way I communicate, in the way I talk, and I don't know. That song has to do a little bit with just like, or was a little inspired maybe by situations that had a conversational pace that felt frenetic to me, or like, you know, manic or exclusive. But then it's the feeling of having a friend that makes you feel really confident, and like being able to just share everything about yourself and your perceptions with them, just feeling like kind of translucent or unmediated. And I wanted to write about that feeling on that song, but you know, maybe that's where I started. That was my point of entry, but then it expanded into other things. And when I write, I think that it's really important for me to follow where the song wants to go. Mm-hmm. You know, there'll be an idea that'll spark it, and then it's more about kind of uncovering this thing that maybe already exists, and just being really patient with it and unwrapping it so it doesn't tear. And sometimes when I unfold the package, it's a little bit surprising the way it comes out, or the things that I'm apparently saying. But with this record especially, there were more drafts lyrically than I had ever done before, and I really wanted to put the lyrics side by side and make sure that there was thematic consistency, and that aesthetic coherence, basically. You know, I'm kind of rambling about my approach, but
no, it's making sense. I mean, you're 26 now, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And when did you first start writing songs?
I was really young. My dad's a composer, so I was always kind of aware of that this thing existed, that you could just make something out of nothing, or like, you know, wrangle the big thing. And my mom too's very creative. She's an interior designer, and I have a absolute obsession with color and visual aesthetics too. So I feel like probably basically since birth, I'd been exposed to these sorts of things, and then started making my own songs when I was young, when I was in elementary school. I actually had a band with my dad called The Reptiles when I was in elementary school.
That's a great band name.
Thank you.
It still is a great, I mean, you could still revive that name, I think.
Yeah, reunion tour, what do you think?
And like, I mean, when you're in grade school, like, what kind of songs, like, were you writing back then? Were you, like, writing about reptiles? Or were, like, were you already, like, autobiographical at that time?
No, there were a little bit more fantastical considerations. There was one, I'm Just a Snail, which was written from the perspective of a snail, which is not a reptile, it's a mollusk, but there's one line that was, don't crush my shell or you'll go to hell. And that was, I felt like a true badass for, you know, like, coming up with that rhyme. This is the pre-swearing era.
Well, and I like that lyric because it works literally and also as a metaphor. Because because if you do crush the shell, you know, you could actually go to hell, but then, you know, the shell could also represent your psyche or something.
Mm-hmm. it's trying to uncover the big questions, definitely, even as far as back then.
And I mean, you said you had a band back then, so like playing music as well, that was also something that you were drawn to at an early age.
Yeah, well, I played drums in The Reptiles and sang. We were a duo and my dad played guitar.
Oh, nice.
And we performed at my fifth grade field day. Or like, you know, end of year May time celebration, end of the school year. Yeah, we somehow wrangled that big gig. I'm now just reflecting on it. It seems kind of crazy that we were able to do that. I'm sure that it was, I don't know, maybe some sort of nepotistic coordination. but yeah, I've been interested in playing and performing for a long time. And then with this particular lineup, I've known Zach, the drummer in the band, since I was in elementary school also. And his brother, Nick, too. Our parents are friends. As a matter of fact, our dads play in a band together still.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, my stepmom sings as well. It's called Julie's Party. My stepmom is Irish, though. There's no Julie in the band. It's kind of a far-out name, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. You know, and I mean, I love the idea of a family band. If I were a better musician, like, I would want to start a family band and tour around and, like, wearing matching pantsuits or something. I just think that would be just the coolest thing to do.
Yeah, it was enormous lapels, lots of sequins.
Now, like, when...
And fur.
Exactly. Like, when did... I mean, you know, you're playing in these bands, you know, starting from grade school, and I assume that your involvement in bands continued into your teen years. Like, I mean, were you like one of those guys that just always had a band?
Yeah, but I was pretty monogamous with it, actually. I played just with Zach and one other guy, Danny Parenti, in a band called Dogwater from 7th grade through 12th grade.
See, that seems like an incredibly long time for, like, a childhood band to stay together.
Yeah. Well, we were really excited about pushing each other in interesting musical directions, and it was just super fulfilling. Both of those musicians were my best friends and the most talented musicians I knew. So it had everything I wanted, you know? There's no reason to... I did play with a couple others. There's a band I was in called Newton's Laws of Emotion, which I still totally stand by as a terrific emo band name. And I played in a lit tribute band called Lint.
Oh, wow, okay. So yeah, all another excellent band name.
Yes, thanks.
Now, I mean, another like reference point that's brought up a lot with Pine Grove is like 90s indie rock, like especially like Built to Spill ends up mentioned in your reviews a lot. I mean, was that, mm-hmm. you know, and you mentioned like, you know, being sort of like an emo influenced band, you know, having those kind of bands in high school, but like, were you all, I mean, is that also like a reference point that you had, or is that something that like reviewers have put on you? You know, like the Built to Spill stuff.
Sure. Well, I have to say I do like a lot of those bands. Built to Spill specifically is one that I'm not like that well listened in. That's a strange way of saying that I'm not that familiar with their work. Also just to go back for a second, Newton's Laws of Emotion was definitely an overtly emo, like kind of a little bit tongue-in-cheek about it, but that was definitely the aim. But Dogwater, to be clear, was like really more of a grunge band.
Oh, right. Yeah, because you have a lot of that in your background, right? I mean, listening to like grunge stuff like early on.
Yeah, totally. So that's really more, that was more formative to me than any of this other stuff. I loved Nirvana and Soundgarden, and Green Day too, other 90s like alternative rock, but you know, I really wasn't exposed to indie rock until like late high school. Maybe was when I first heard Death Cab for Cutie, which was I think really an important entry point for that whole realm of stuff.
I mean, like,
for me,
I mean, like for someone your age, I mean, you know, like Nirvana and Soundgarden is like practically classic rock. I mean, because I mean, Nirvana certainly came and went like when you were, you know, a little kid, basically. I mean, like, what attracted you to those bands when you were a teenager?
Well, okay, so Nirvana, yes, did predate, you know, I wasn't listening to them while they were a contemporary band, but I was really into bands like Green Day and Live, for example. They put out the album Throwing Copper in 1996, and Secret Samadhi in 98 or something like that. So I graduated elementary school in the year 2000, which, I just happen to remember. But so I think maybe I can thank babysitters and au pairs I had who had just terrific musical taste and turned me on to that sort of stuff when I was young. Also, the presidents of the United States of America were really big for me as a kid. But then just like, yeah, the whole like Green Day and Bush, and basically we're talking about very melodic but, like, decently heavy pop music.
I mean, like, a lot of these bands that you're mentioning, like, are not cool anymore. Like, you know, Live, Presidents of the United States of America, Bush. Will you still defend these bands today?
Yeah, I think I would. And Green Day is, I think, probably an especially polarizing case because there's plenty of fertile argument against their body of work since, Nimrod, maybe.
Right.
I think that's kind of the turning point. But I
like Nimrod a lot, by the way. Are you Nimrod?
Oh, yeah.
You like Nimrod?
That's kind of, I like about half of it, really.
Yeah. There's some really good melodic songs.
Insomniac, I think, is. Yeah, it's true. There's definitely good work on it. But Dookie and Insomniac were just totally the sweet spot for me, and I would definitely still go to the mat for them. I think those are great albums.
Yeah, Insomniac, that's got like Geeks Think Breath on it, and what else is on that record? Like
Armitage Walking Shanks.
Right.
The first song on it, Walking Contradiction.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Brain Stew, Jaded.
Right, that was the big radio
the
song.
The dual music video.
Right. You mentioned earlier about how when you were writing songs for Cardinal that you went through the most drafts that you've ever gone through for lyrics. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about your evolution as a songwriter. I mean, it seems like you're a very thoughtful guy in terms of not just how each song is put together, but how the songs fit together in terms of an album, and even how the album is presented in terms of the artwork and all that. I mean, is that something that's always been true for you, or do you feel like you've kind of progressed in that direction, as you've gotten better as a songwriter?
I'd like to think it was always a consideration, but I think I'm just getting better at it the more I do it, just like anything. But I think probably the most like thematically coherent or conceptual release of ours was the Ampersand EP, and that was in 2013 or 14 or something like that. I wrote the majority of it at like in the last few weeks of college, and I graduated in 2011. So that was kind of gestating for a while, and I was. It's more or less, it's similar themes, really, but an ode to human connection and, parenthetically, disconnection through the lens of symbolic logic, which I was taking at the time when I was writing it, and I ended up getting kind of a bad grade in that class, which sort of rocked me. It was like, damn, I put so much effort into this and really kind of cared about it and ultimately wasn't able to do it that well. And maybe that partly had to do with that I set up a rule for myself where if I was writing a song and I also had a school assignment, I would prioritize the writing of it. I always considered my studies as like kindling for writing interesting music.
I mean, are you a person that is actually like sitting down and saying like, okay, I'm going to block off this amount of time each day or whatever, and I'm going to write songs? I mean, are you that kind of songwriter?
Categorically, no. I do that also, but really, descriptively, it's more like there's this thing and I'm trying to chase it, and yeah. I don't get to choose when the thing appears. It's just like all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's a melody. I gotta go, guys. Sorry.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. I know that for me, when I write stuff, a lot of times I have to write something in order to know how I feel about what I'm writing about.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's kind of true for you too.
Yes.
And like, how do you know when you get there with a song? Because I mean, it's one thing to actually like write a book or whatever, because you can read it and it seems more tangible in a way. With a song, you know, there's lyrics and there's chords and all that stuff, but there is that sort of missing intangible thing that you can't describe. And I would think that that would be really hard to chase. I'm just wondering, like, when do you know that you've got it?
I do know when I have it. And I think it's worth mentioning that I write at least twice as many songs as I put out, if not more. And so, like, knowing when you have it is definitely an important tool in my set. Just like being a strong editor of my own work and being a ruthless editor too. But I would say too that the intangible thing you're talking about, maybe we could call mood or I don't know, feel. That exists in a book too. You know, in any temporal art form, any art, like not just temporally based stuff. But I guess I'm thinking about books too, because you brought that up. And actually, there's an interesting quote from one of my favorite authors, George Saunders, about the creative process that goes something like. It's advice to writers, where he describes his process as he reads his story from the beginning until he gets to a point where maybe he loses interest a little bit, or there's something about it that isn't as exciting, and so he focuses on that detail until he can make it exciting, and then he starts from the beginning again and sees if transitionally it works. And it works as far as momentum is concerned. And once you can identify all those little issues and resolve them, then you've solved the puzzle, and then you have a good work. So I think I do that. I do that too. But it's more just about like playing the song from the beginning and seeing when there needs to be a new section or like, I actually have a little bit of a rule for myself that I like to make whatever deviation as minute as possible. Like to really just be, if there needs to be another point of interest introduced, then I try to make it as subtle as possible. And I guess that's why you'll find that a lot of my songs are just like pretty repetitive. You brought up aphasia. That's kind of just the same chords almost the entire song.
Right. And that's what I mean, like where, you know, like we're talking about what to call this this intangible. You know, Jason Lee and Almost Famous calls it the fucking buzz. You know, the fucking
sure.
buzz there. Because yeah, you can have a song that on paper might seem boring because it's just the same chords, or maybe the lyrics are, you know, there's not much to the lyrics, but then they come together in a way that totally works, and like it communicates something that's greater than the sum of whatever parts are in it. And that's what I think is maybe uniquely magical about music, is that there's something sort of invisible there that you can't put your finger on about like why it works, but you hear it and it just kind of hits you in the right place. That, I don't know, maybe because I'm a writer, that doesn't seem as mysterious to me as the music thing does. But
well, it's funny because I mean, I definitely agree that that this magic exists in music, but maybe because I'm not really a long form writer, that seems very mystical to me. Like when you read a passage, especially someone who's like very fluid with long sentences, like maybe Wallace or Faulkner, you are just transported, and sometimes the sentence will pivot, and I find myself rereading the sentence to figure out exactly the moment that it changes into this glorious thing. It's kind of like a takeoff ramp, and it's like, all right, when is it airborne?
right.
But yeah, I don't know. I think that it's just sort of a you know when you know.
Right.
There's no real answer, but I do try to listen for it, and right. It is, I agree, an important, like that I mentioned before, I write a lot more songs than the ones that I put out, and it's really, it's a binary thing. It's like, does it have that thing or not?
Right.
And so I'm always listening for that thing, and I think I know it when I hear it, and sometimes I'll go kind of a long time without being able to make a thing that does the thing, and that's really sad, but just try to keep my head down and keep working.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about what I feel like makes Pine Grove unique. And from talking with you, I mean, you seem like a pretty analytical guy, or at least the guy who likes to think about how things work and why they work and how you can make them better. Like with Pine Grove, I feel what stands out to me is just, and maybe it is those country influences that, your band gets slotted in sort of the punk emo category, but you don't really sound like any other bands that are in that category right now. You seem to be doing your own thing. And, in historically, like punk has been at times sort of a conformist music. Like a lot of bands sort of sound alike, and they're expected to adhere to a certain sort of range of influences and sonics and all that stuff. And if you deviate from that, you're no longer considered a punk band or something.
I agree. There's a pretty strict formalism to genre considerations in general, but some are more strict than others. Right.
I mean, I'm just wondering, like how conscious are you of like trying to buck that and do something that isn't maybe so straight down the line as far as like what the band sounds like and how it relates to other maybe bands in that genre?
Well, I think the short answer is I don't really think about it.
right.
And that's the best way to make something that's idiosyncratic, is to make it kind of in isolation. Of course, I'm listening to all that stuff, and I like a lot of contemporary emo bands. I'm friends with them. We play music together. I'm a fan of also like lots of alt country or weird folk, like Bonnie Prince Billy or Phosphorescent or Wilco or Gillian Welch. There are a lot of different iterations of it. Or even like Torches, essentially turning out country product. Not this most recent thing, but you know what I'm saying? There are lots of examples too of what we're doing. I mean, I appreciate that you hear something special in it. I don't think we're totally alone, but mainly I think the way that our music happens and the way it might sound so much like itself is I'm really writing with myself as an ideal listener, and I have maybe kind of idiosyncratic or particular or like neurotically developed tastes, and I'm first and foremost trying to satisfy myself as a listener and use my own sensibilities as the strongest metric I have.
Right.
So I'm just following my nose. Is basically the answer.
Well, your nose is pointed in the right direction, I think.
Thank you.
Evan, congrats on Cardinal. I think it's a great record, and I know you're going to be touring here soon. You're going to be playing on that great package with Into It Over It, The World is a Beautiful Place, and The Sidekicks, and I'm in Minneapolis. I think the last date of the tour is here in Minneapolis.
Yes.
So,
yes, we're very excited. I've never been to your city. I really look forward to visiting.
And I've seen The Sidekicks, but I haven't seen you or the other two bands. So I'm excited. I'm really excited for that tour. I think it's going to be one of the great tours of the spring. So, congrats on the record. And it was really great talking with you, Evan.
Yeah, really nice talking to you too. Thanks for calling me.
Okay, so that was Evan Stevens Hall from Pine Grove. That was a great conversation. And, of course, spoke with Amber Weber from Black Mountain earlier in the episode. Again, those are two of my favorite records of early 2016. And it's been a really great year so far. I have high hopes for the rest of the year. Guys, if you love the podcast, it really helps if you help us spread the word. So just take a moment to tell your friends about us. Give us a rating on iTunes. Or say nice things about us in social media. Of course, if you didn't like what you just heard, don't tell anyone. Just keep it to yourself. We would appreciate it. Other than that, I hope you guys really enjoyed the episode, and we will talk to you next week.